On a été amené à parler assez longuement des inscriptions proto-sogdiennes de Kultobé au sud-Kazakhstan qui sont fondamentales pour la question de l'histoire de l'Empire Kangkyu. Et donc je signalais avec Sims Williams qui est venu ici que il y a un problème de datation. On a l'évidence épigraphique qui tend à indiquer une date assez vraiment haute, mais c'est pas forcément un critère tout à fait fiable. Et puis l'évidence, le contexte archéologique n'est pas précis. Ça peut se promener entre le 1er et le 3e siècle de notre ère. Évidemment, tout ça a des implications sur l'analyse historique qu'on peut faire du contexte. Et on terminait en concluant que le seul moyen probablement de sortir de cette impasse serait de faire des tests de thermoluminescence sur ces plaques, parce que normalement elles s'y prêtent, puisque c'est de la céramique cuite. Et c'est assez précis, les tests de thermoluminescence. Alors j'expliquais donc que ça n'avait pas l'air facile de mettre au point, parce qu'il semblait qu'il n'avait pas cette technologie au Kazakhstan, et il paraît dans les circonstances actuelles vraiment impossible de faire exporter des fragments. Alors finalement, voilà, il y a deux jours, j'ai eu des informations suite à mes interventions. Bon, les autorités du musée d'Almaty ont trouvé un partenaire pour ces tests. C'est l'Institut de physique nucléaire du Kazakhstan qui apparemment a déjà des contrats de collaboration, des accords de collaboration avec le musée d'Almaty où sont déposées ces plaques. Et donc apparemment plusieurs même ils vont faire des tests sur vraiment un grand nombre de plaques, et les résultats me seront communiqués apparemment assez bien, assez vite. Donc, on devrait, n'est-ce pas, assez rapidement avoir des indications intéressantes. Alors, évidemment, il ne faudrait pas que ça donne des résultats trop différents d'une plaque à l'autre, parce qu'il y a une chose dont on est sûr, c'est qu'elles ont été cuites en même temps. Mais on peut espérer avoir quand même là-dessus quelque chose de fiable sur lequel se baser. Et donc, la substance de tout ça passera dans le résumé qu'on fera paraître du séminaire, et puis probablement aussi dans mes interventions l'année prochaine. Voilà, c'est ce que je voulais dire, et maintenant je passe la parole à Chao Zhou.
Merci. Merci à France. Please let me continue encore en anglais. Our text reading since last Friday. Last Friday, at the end, I announced that I will read the treatment, the text reading from her survey today. Also, I once criticized that her survey sometimes could not apply for. Could not use Japanese bibliography very well, but it has some advantages. So, last week I gave Zhang Qian's timeline during his first mission to the West according to Kuwabala 1916, and I said today I will treat two attestations of Kangju in the Han dynasty even before Zhang Qian's arrival to the territory of the Great Yuezhi, namely northern Afghanistan. And I also said once that the year here, 134 BCE and 130 basically follows on Yu Taishan's revised edition in Chinese on the history of Saka people. Okay, so the last slide I treat last week is this slide, so let me repeat it a little bit more. So, from the note 298 of Hull Survey's book, his translation of the Han Shu, he said. However, two texts mention Kang Ju some years before the return of the Zhang Qian in 126 or 125 BC. And I said that this is the note based on Soifert, Elvet, and Shi Zhimian, right? So let's see Holy Survey's bibliography concerning the text one. So here I said that there are two texts and I will treat it one by one. First text one and second text two. So this is the bibliography for the text one, the basic bibliography. And we see, as Holy Survey comment, the text one refers to this pink passage. The other, namely the second text, referred to his, in his note, but actually it's my text one. The other is a memorial by Dong Zhongshu, presented either in 136 or 134 BC, and it was translated by Soifert. And as I shall explain a little bit more, this romanization of Chinese name follows the White Zhao's Chinese romanization. It's an British system developed in the 19th century. And unfortunately, this is a wrong page number, perhaps due to a careless error or a misplacement of footnote. Actually, as I tried to consult the original paper, a German paper written by Soifert, only with one F, it is translated from page 30 to 39 and in a section of Zweite Denkschrift. So let's see the life of Soifert. As far as I can search from the web, he was born in Germany, in Western Germany, and then in his young days, he was once in Qingdao in today's China and around here. And then for a historical reason, because the war between Japan and Germany just around that area in China, you know, that is imperial and colonial period. So he was captured to Japan and learned Chinese in Japan. And then he once returned to Hamburg very briefly, and actually he obtained a PhD diploma there in Hamburg, and his supervisor is Otto Franke, that we used his map very many times during our last seminars. So the subject of his dissertation, where we found the translation of Dong Zhongshu, is Urkunden zur staatlichen Neuordnung unter der Han-Dynastie. So document or sources for a state reorganization, or namely the reform of Chinese Empire in the Han Dynasty. And finally, after his PhD dissertation, he returned to Qingdao here for a long period. So actually, I just went to Berlin after the last seminar last Friday because of this event for the 80th birthday of our dear professor, Dr. Peter Zimmer. So I used this chance to visit the State Library of Berlin and try to find this very rare journal. So this is the Journal of Mitteilungen der Seminar für Orientalische Sprachen and the Friedrich Wilhelm Universität zu Berlin, or that is a bulletin of the Oriental Languages Seminar of today's Humboldt University in Berlin. And fortunately, I could get a copy just in 2 days, even during the weekend, and then I received more information just 2 days ago by the help of Dr. Tora Franstein of the Orient Abteilung. So this is the year of 1922, and I just start to quote what Soifert has translated this biography of Dong Zhongshu into German almost 100 years ago. So, nun beherrschen eure Majestät das Weltreich. So I just translate very roughly and very awkwardly into French. Maintenant, votre majesté gouverne l'empire, literally sous le ciel. and il n'y a rien entre les quatre mers qui ne vous soit soumis. Okay? So here we have the term 天下, and literally sous le ciel, under the sky or under the heaven. And then this term of Hainan means actually the world, but we say that in half der mer or entre les quatre mers. So the attestation of Kangju appeared in the next paragraph and just near another people or state called Yelang. So here I give the date of Dong Zhongshu. This is a very famous philosopher and politician in Han Dynasty. According to the book recently published by Belles Lettres in 2017, and by Professor Madame Bujard and also Madame Pirazzoli Seal-Stevens. So France, I think you know them very well. Yes, Madame Bujard.
Of course, Pirazzoli Seal-Stevens, I'm not sure she's alive now, and but she was a very influential sinologist,
yes.
An excellent specialist, I would say a pioneer,
yes.
Of Chinese archaeology and art. The new. She was aware of the newest discoveries. And she taught a long time at the Institute. By the way, she was the professor of Mrs. Corinne Frankfort, who wrote her PhD under her supervision.
Okay. Actually, I do not know them personally, I mean these two professors, but it seems that Madame Pirazzoli died in 2018?
Yes.
Yes, okay. So anyway, this Dong Zhongshu, he is a famous philosopher, politician, and classical scholar, and also a famous writer in the history of Belles Lettres in China. So actually, you will find many passages concerning Dong Zhongshu in this book, because this is the index of the book. Okay. So I just continue this phrase. Now your Imperial Majesty, namely Wu Emperor, has unified the whole empire, literally under the heaven. And this Wu Emperor refer to the timeline that we used many times. This is the first emperor that I used in this table, but well, he was not the founder of the Han Dynasty, just the first most important emperor for our concern. So look, this Wu Emperor, he is one of the most successful expansionist emperors in historical China. And Liz Wu is a posthumous name for emperor in Imperial China, and it basically means military power. So here we see now the Wu Emperor has unified the whole empire of Han China, right? And here I think that the passage 并有天下 has unified the whole empire actually means the centralization of imperial power, namely after the revolt, this revolt from this map of the book in 154 BCE during the reign of his father. And afterward, the Han China gradually shifted from the feudalism to a kind of prefectural administration system called Junxianzhi, namely administrated by commanderies, juns, and counties, xian. So a few weeks ago, when explaining the site of Xuanquan wooden tablet, where it was from, I once take this map from Rong Xinjiang's book, and I said that, well, this is the seat of Dunhuang Commandery as well as Dunhuang County, and this is the seat of Xiaoguo County. And actually, there are more counties under the government of this Dunhuang Commandery. So, okay. Now, during the centralization process, under the rule of Wu Di, I just continue this very essential phrase. So Soifeld, he translated, So haben die Jelang und Kangju wohl, Li entfernt gegangen, in eure Tugend gefallen gefunden und eure Gerechtigkeit sich an Wert haut. Das ist die Wirkung des allgemeinen Friedens. So into French. Ainsi le Yelang et le Kangju, distants de quelques 10 000 li, ont trouvé une faveur or prigoutte à votre vertu. Ils se sont confiés à votre justice. C'est l'effet de la paix générale. So, if you compare with Yu Taishan's English translations, he translated in the first edition of his History of Saka People, here that Yelang and Kangju, the place beyond 10,000 li, enjoys virtues and submit to justice. And this is caused by peace. So, this usage of submit to justice, from this aspect, we can say that Yu Taishan's English translation is actually very close to Seufert, although it is not or not explicitly cited in Yu Taishan's bibliography. Now, just give you a brief impression on the location of Yelang. So, Yelang actually is around here, around today's Guizhou province. And if we use another collection of map that we used many times, so 中国历史地图集, the Chinese official historical maps, it is put here, and here is the capital of Chang'an in the Western Han Dynasty. And by putting it into another French map in the middle 19th century, so the capital Chang'an is here, and here is the Yelang. So the problem is that, well, not a real problem, but maybe some of you will interested in a more literal translation. So I would translate this phrase in English as follows. The states of Yelang and Kangju, being so remote and situated beyond 10,000 li, find their joy at your virtues and express their good proper terms to you. So here this express refer to Gui, and literally it means return, but it can also mean further affiliated or take refuge or submit. And here good or proper terms, yi. It basically means good relations or proper relations, but it can also means widely, I mean very frequently, friendship or less likely justice, but it is also possible. So to express or submit their good or proper terms to you, to the emperor, and this is the result of the peace, the lasting peace or widespread peace established by you. So in general, this whole text is very flattery. I mean, it's a very sweet word to the emperor. So it could, it might explain why this text was not collected by Shi Ji, because the author of Shi Ji, Sima Qian, he was a very critical person, truly, to the government of the Wu Emperor. So actually he avoided to collect this kind of flattery text, flattery literature as much as possible. And actually before his death, the draft of his Shi Ji already becomes somehow interdicts among the educated peoples, just because it does not coincide with the official view of the Han court. Yes. But because of another kind of punishment. Right, so let's continue. Here, Hulsevei just continue to refer Qi Shaonan by quoting Seufert, because this is a sinologist in the Qing dynasty used by this German sinologist. But then again, I checked the paper, and actually it was somehow to be placed here from page 4 and to page 6, that's why I explained that it could be a misplacement of footnote. And then here, Wang Xianqian, if in Pinyin, that would give Wang Xianqian, a very famous sinologist during Qing Dynasty. And then here, he mentioned Shi Zhimian, a sinologist born in mainland China but moved to Taiwan in 1948. All these, I mean, these Shi, Qi Shaonan and Wang Xianqian here, and Shi Zhimian, they were all romanized by Wade Giles Chinese romanization system. And as I said, this is a system built by a professor of Chinese in Cambridge in United Kingdoms. And his predecessor is Wade, the first professor of Chinese language in Cambridge, also in UK. So, for historical reason, this system was widely adopted in East and Southeast Asia, including Hong Kong and mainland China and Taiwan, as the official system. But in 1958, the mainland China started to apply a new romanization system called Pinyin. So, but Shi Zhimian here, it is not just a romanization. This is to be perceived as his official name on some identity documents, such as passport. So you will find Shi Zhimian's work as early as Evoet and Hulsevet. So I would say that it was this French sinologist Evoet who first paid attention to the dating of Shi Zhimian concerning our attestation of Kangju. Now, here comes the annoying problem, or a very, troublesome problem for a Chinese student in West when looking for so much various spelling romanization of Chinese name in different kind of works. So for the traditional Wade Giles system in English work, you will find Tong Zhong Shu, Qi Shaonan like that. And if O was mechanically transposed to Pinyin, it will be give like that. But in French convention, you know, there is a special system according to the pronunciation of in French. So now we scholar agree to each other that all historical person is to be spelled in Pinyin. But Wang Xianqian, I mean this modern scholar who lived at the turn of the 20th century, it depends on how one define his career. But it will be strange to spell this very modern scholar's name just to Pinyin or French convention, because this name is the name as his identity. And I have to emphasize this kind of problem because for me, I also found a various transcription of my own name on academia or different devices. But actually, my name in Taiwan and also in mainland China, according to the local rules in Taiwan and mainland China, is always to be put like this. There is no other kind of spelling. So, that's to say that if you find Shi Zhimian like that in French convention, it is always very difficult to identify them as the same person. And this might explain why Evoet's translation about this text of Kangju was so far neglected by many French colleagues in Iranian scholars, because this table was just too complicated for those who are not so familiar with classical Chinese. Okay, so let's continue to Sophia's translation, but I just read the very raw French translation. So, dans les notes critiques de texte sur le cinquième chapitre du Qian Han Shu, l'un des éditeurs de l'édition Qianlong de ses ouvrages historiques, Qi Shaonan note qu'à propos de l'année du Dong Zhong Shu, répondit aux édits impériaux, des doutes existaient même parmi les premiers érudits confuciens. So here you see this is another kind of German convention spelling Chinese names. So here this dating problem is quite complicated. Sophia said, certains l'ont daté à la première année du règne Yuan Guang, et les autres à la première année du règne Jian Yuan. Il, c'est-à-dire Qi Shaonan, considère que les deux déclarations sont fausses et décide de la cinquième année de règne Jian Yuan. So this is what Sophia tried to adopt it as the final date of Dong Zhongshu, namely the first attestation of Kang Ju in the Chinese sources. And this is what Hulsevi referred to in this line. Actually, this this text written by Dong Zhongshu is a very important text because this is from a series of three imperial edicts and three answers submitted by Dong Zhongshu in the form of a memory submitted to the emperor. And this concerns a very important historical question on how Confucianism was adopted by the Emperor Wu after the official, as the official ideology of the Tang Dynasty. So if you read the book of this this book published in 2017, I just quoted the whole paragraph by doing some omission. So there is a paragraph specially dedicated to Dong Zhongshu. Le nom de Dong Zhongshu est indissociable du triomphe du confucianisme sous les Han. Le lettre est passé pour l'artisan de l'orthodoxie confucienne qui, en réalité, ne s'installera que progressivement au cours de la dynastie. Blabla. Cependant, l'historiographie avait besoin d'un porte-drapeau et ce fut Dong Zhongshu. À l'occasion du deuxième appel aux hommes de talon de tout l'Empire en 134 avant notre ère, it is the text we are treating right now, and le premier appel avait eu lieu en 141. Dong Zhongshu répondit par écrit aux trois séries de questions formulées par l'empereur. Dans ses dissertations, le lettré expose sa vision du monde et la manière appropriée de le gouverner. Au fait du système philosophique qu'il a conçu se tient le ciel. And I just keep the more development of this, the influence of his text. So now, where is Yelang? As I said, Yelang is in southwest China. And actually from Shiji, we know that the first addition to Yelang is in 135 BCE. That is the criteria that we determine the date of this text as early as perhaps 134 BCE. And this background was explained by Evoet actually in his book, Un poète de cour sous le Han, Sima Xiangru. So Evoet, he was a French sinologist, and I think Grenet, France, you also know him very well.
I didn't meet him personally, but he was well known.
Yes. So I just cited his explanation on the background of Li's mission to Southeast China very briefly. So in his book, Evoet said, en 135 avant notre ère, à l'occasion d'une expédition impériale contre le Ming Yue, un fonctionnaire chinois nommé Tang Meng est chargé d'aller porter les instructions du chef des troupes chinoises au roi de Nan Yue, qui ne cherche qu'à se soumettre. So, here is the Ming Yue around today's Fujian, and here is Nan Yue around today's Guangzhou. Okay. And Evoet continued. De retour dans la capitale, il, Tang Meng, a pris des marchands du Shu around today's Sichuan province. So here, around here. This is Shu. Que la plante qu'on lui avait donnée à manger était originaire de leur pays et qu'ils en faisaient bien un commerce vers le Yelang. And after one more paragraph, dans ces récits, actually, des marchands à Tangmen, le Yelang était présenté comme une population de guerriers valeureux. And if we read further in Hanshu, the number of soldiers of the Yelang people or of the Yelang state is 100,000 soldiers. So I said that the soldier of Yelang is 100,000 good soldiers, right, in today's Southeast China. And on the other hand, Kangju, we don't know how many soldiers there were around the same year, but we know that in the same book and in the next chapter, the military power of Kangju is stated as the 120,000 good soldiers, but perhaps this is a data around the first century BCE. So there is a kind of a gap. And now the problem is that if you see that the distance between the center of Han China and Yelang is said to be beyond 10,000 li, but actually it was just exaggerating. It actually refers to the distance between Kangju and the center of Han China, but this is still too distant because, as I said, 10,000 li would be around 4,000 kilometers, right? So at any rate, it is a kind of exaggerating and flattery to the Han Emperor. So if you find Yu's book on his first English edition of the History of Saka document, he expressed the dating of the text one as follows. Dong Zhongshu presented the memorial in the first year of the Yuan Guang reign period in this year. So that's what I adopt for the timeline for the usage of our seminar. So it is actually a tentative dating. And actually he gave more explanation and details, controversy, and even two or three more papers to be consulted. But no matter how scholars debated on the exact date of this memorial by Dong Zhongshu, it was at any rate no doubt before Zhang Qian's return to China in 126 BCE from his first mission to the West. So I think I have finished the reading of text one until now. So if Hans, do you have any comment on this?
It does not tell us where was Kangju at that time.
No, because the distance.
No way.
No.
Beside, as you say, the only indication is the distance, and it is conventional. And
yes.
There is no indication to direction,
not
to neighborhood.
No. But
so we just don't know.
Yes.
Were they already far in the west? Hardly so. It was probably before they migrated. But migrated from where?
Right. Yes. So far we can only say that Chinese already heard about Kangju even before Zhang Qian's return from the West, but so far we do not know how it happened in this earliest date.
Some remark about the transcription system used by French sinologists.
Yes.
Actually, you say the French system was established by Chavannes and Hervé.
Yes.
But eventually, it was made more official by Pelliot. It was publicized,
yes,
as the EFEO system proposed by Pelliot just before or just after the war. And because of Pelliot's prestige, there was a resistance among French sinologists for a long time to use pinyin. I remember my predecessor Louis Ambis whose classes I followed in the 1970s, he completely rejected Pinyin because he said nobody could do better than Pinyin. So eventually the resistance gave up. But I noticed, for example, that Jacques Germain, in the French edition of his La Civilisation Chinoise, which is still classical, uses Pinyin. But the English edition,
yes,
uses Wade Giles.
Yes.
And it is still sold everywhere in university bookshops in the United States. But I don't think today an American or British publisher would use Wade Giles anymore.
Only maybe a few very traditional journals, and even some journals in Japan, but published in English.
The sad result is that probably the English edition of Jacques Germain's book eventually will not be reprinted.
The problem is that sometimes as many Western editors just mechanically transcribe all the names into Pinyin without asking the identity and the local roles. I mean, today we are modernized, and I think one should pay respect to the local roles and conventions. As I said, actually, this is not a name chosen by myself or any kind. It is a name registered to the official document. So even in mainland China, I only have one name, and there is no other expression. And I think it is not only a problem for me, it could happen on many scholars from the Third World, for example, how to properly transcribe a Russian scholar's name or the names of from another Arabic or Turkish language. It's all the same problem.
There are not so many variations now because for the transcription of Russian,
yeah,
where more or less the systems are converging, for Arabic and Persian, we have good standards now, the Encyclopédie de l'Islam and Encyclopédie Iranica. Okay. Unfortunately, I realize that now there is no French scholar anymore would use Pelios for transcription.
Okay.
And this was the last one.
So maybe we can go to the text two, right? So the ones about 130 BCE and second attestation of Kangju in Chinese sources. So this text was basically from the biography of Sima Xiangru and from 79 to 117 BCE. And parallel text could be found in Shiji as well as in Hanshu, and even some other parallel texts collect in Wenxuan and other Chinese classics, because this belles lettres is so famous in the history of Chinese literature. So if we only compare the wording of the essential phrase between the one in Shiji and the one in Hanshu, we find that Kangju appear at the beginning of the passage, okay? And then the difference is this verbal phrase, 请朝, or request for an official visit to the Han court, while the Hanshu said modestly from that pays tribute by offering gift or specialty. I mean, Kangju appear itself more modestly to the Han court. So this phrase was translated into French by Evouet as well. So I just quote his text with this very phrase. And le pays de Kangju et les territoires de l'Ouest, par le truchement de plusieurs interprètes, demandèrent à venir à la cour. Et le front contre terre offrirent des présents. And also, because of the introduction of Hol Sevet, this text was also, this is what Josefe treat in his note 298. One of these texts is the address by Sima Xiangru to the governors of Ba and Shu, to be dated approximately in 131. And this is the used various dating on the same text. You see that actually he was hesitating, but as far as I can see, he finally determined the dating as the 130s, and there is a reason. But again, any rate, before Zhang Qian's this date, no matter how scholars debate from 133 to 130, this is before Zhang Qian's return from his first mission to the West. And in Yu's view, the mention of Kangju by the two writers, the one by Dong Zhongshu and the one by Sima Xiangru here, might refer to one and the same diplomatic event. And unfortunately, this event was not preserved in the official annals right now available to us. So this is what I combined with this Yu Taishan's date to Kuwabala's timeline. So if we put this onto the map, we see that last time I said Zhang Qian was dispatched to find the Da Yue Zhi, and after finding so long, he finally found Da Yue Zhi has moved and settled down around northern Afghanistan. And his departure was as early as 139 BCE, right? But he arrived there around 11 years after. And the itinerary of his departure from Chang'an, the capital of Han China, via Li Xiongnu, because he was detained there for more than 10 years, this itinerary was not so sure. And on the other hand, almost just 4 years after Zhang Qian's mission, the Wu Emperor decided to send another mission to the southwest. And this is just 4 years after, so to this direction. And then we know that perhaps the first Kangju envoy known to the Han China was before 134 BCE, if we accepted Yu Taishan's view that both could refer to the same event, diplomatic event. So, but actually I would say that, well, we do not know if this actually involved a real official envoy from the Kangju, or just a refugee, a group of refugee, or just a caravan of merchant. So
it could actually be already soldiers under the cover of Kangju.
Perhaps, but
it could even
yes,
be that.
Yes. I mean, it is a possibility, but we have to consider it more. So let me continue. So I just mentioned the French translation of this very essential passage in the text too, right? But if we look the whole text too, it could be divided into three parts. The first part is the historical background, and the second part is the, I would say, text 2A, the part A, and then third part is text 2B. And part A concerns Sima Xiangru's announcement on behalf of the Han Emperor to local people around today's Sichuan province in southwest China. And this is where we see a mention of Kangju. And then on the part B is the Sima Xiangru's report or memory to the Han Emperor after the mission, after he came back from the southwest China back to the Chang'an capital. And this part B had a very clear date. It is dated 129 BCE. So that's why that we feel safe to say that this text too was at any rate before 129 BCE. And I will explain this briefly. So this is actually a pair of pages from It was book, so it was the text 2A and as well as the historical background. And this is the first attestation of Kang Ju in the Shiji chapter 129, because as I said, text 1 was only found in Han Shu. So this was text 2, which occurred both in the Han Shu and Shiji. And this was this is found in a biography of Sima Xiang Ru, and it is attested in an imperial proclamation, Xi, to local governors to today's Sichuan, and composed by Sima Xiang Ru himself. So you know that classical Chinese is to be read from the right to left and from up to the downside. So this is the historical background. Start from here with many small characters of later commentaries. And then until here, this is all historical background. And then this is the beginning of text 2A. And until here, you see this is the attestation of Kang Ju. And now I just start to cite Elvet, but transform the French conventional transcription to pinyin. So the historical background said, Xiang Ru était depuis plusieurs années gentilhomme de la cour. Lorsque Tang Meng fut envoyé ouvrir et rattaché à l'Empire le pays de Yelang et de Bozhong. Now here is a problem that the underlying character Xi is not translated by Edward. So if I translated literally, there could be a different solution. For example, the first is to the west of Yelang and to Bozhong. And the second alternative solution is to Bozhong, west of Yelang. And where is Yelang? As I said, Yelang was here to the south west of Han's capital, western Han capital Chang'an. And around here is the Bozhong, and indeed it was somehow to the west of Yelang. So I continue. We just finished this word, and then Tang Meng, il avait enrôlé dans les commanderies de Ba et de Shu un millier de petits fonctionnaires et de soldats. So where is the Ba and the Shu? These are names of two commanderies. If I just keep using the Zhongguo Lishi Dituji, you will find Ba in today's Chongqing and Shu in today's Chengdu. So just have a look of how to say this map. This is a patchwork from two maps, so actually the boundary is not very good, but you see that Shu Jun, the seat of Shu commandery, was around today's Chengdu, and then the Ba was around today's Chongqing. All are still very important city nowadays. And then if we used a French map just published in 2017, also it was cut into two pages, you see that here he explained, the author explained that this orange part is commandery Jun, but still a little part of the empire was, keep the system of feudalism. So this is the Huayong, to be governed by a princess and relative of the imperial family. And here is the Ba and Shu in this kind of relations. And if we put it again on this old map in the middle 19th century, it's kind of that. So the Han Wu Emperor was just an important expansionist who tried to explore the territory of the Han Dynasty to not only to the southeast, but also to the southwest and to the northwest. Okay. And then to the next phrase. dans ces deux commanderies de Bâle et de Chou, en levant encore dans ce but plus de 10 000 hommes pour les transports par terre et par eau. Tang Meng avait, I will say, le gouverneur du Bâle et de Chou avait utilisé la loi sur les réquisitions militaires, Xingfa, so it's a law to punish the military soldiers, and well, it's not an ordinary law, but a military law, so it was too cruel, pour exécuter des chefs de tribus. Et alors, la population du Bâle et de Chou furent dans une grande frayeur. L'empereur l'a pris, Shang Wenzhi, 乃使相如责唐蒙. Alors, l'empereur envoya Shang Ru réprimander Tang Meng et, par la même occasion, montrer aux populations du Bâle et du Chou que tel n'était pas le dessein de l'empereur. Therefore, we find the beginning of the text 2a, the proclamation. Sa proclamation disait, Si Yue, and here is the 2a, Gao Ba Shu Tai Shou, au gouverneur du Bâle et du Chou, Man Yi Zi Shan, Bu Tao Zhi Ri Jiu Yi. Les barbares agissent à leur guise, car il y a longtemps qu'on n'a pas fait d'expédition punitive contre eux. You know, this is a kind of imperial expression. Shi Qing Fan Bien Jing, Lao Shi Dai Fu. Leurs fréquentes incursions à l'intérieur de nos frontières donnent bien du mal à nos fonctionnaires. Bixia Ji Wei, Cun Fu Tianxia, Ji An Zhongguo. Quand notre empereur a accédé au trône avec grande sollicitude, il a mis en ordre l'univers. Ranhou Xin Shi Chu Bing, Bei Zheng Xiong Nu. Après avoir unifié et pacifié l'empire du milieu, as I said, it was a kind of centralizing the power, imperial power within the territory of China. Il a levé des armées et fait des expéditions militaires vers le nord contre les Xiongnu. Chan Yu Bu Hai, Jiao Bi Shou Shi, Chu Qi Xing He. Le Chan Yu prit peur, joignit les mains pour recevoir des ordres, ploya les genoux pour demander la paix. Et Kangju Xi Yu, Chong Yi Qing Chao, Qi Shou Lai Xiang. Les pays de Kangju et les territoires de l'Ouest, par le truchement de plusieurs interprètes, demandèrent à venir à la cour et à la. Excusez-moi. Et le front contre terre offrir des présents. Yes, I will explain. So, actually, this is a prototype of Pian Wen, literally parallel writing, a very classical flowery text in classical China. And this Pian Wen, the parallel writing, was a very stylized prose style, and that means the regular lines of terms and proper names and flowery wordings were all arranged in couplet. For example, if we see this pair here, Chu Qi ploya le genou, and then followed by Qing He, pour demander la paix. And then this is the end of the second phrase. Ils le front contre terre, or literally bowed their head to the ground. So here we have genou and head, and ploya, and then bowed. So these are verb and verb, and nouns for body, like a part of body. And then, qi shou lai xiang, bowed their head to the ground, and then translated by a word as offrir des présents. So again, a parallel writing, demander la paix et offrir des présents. So a similar rhetorical analysis could be also applied to the previous sub passage. So again, Jiao Bei Shou Shi, joignit les mains pour recevoir des ordres. So here, Jiao, joignit, and recevoir, Shou are two verbs, And then 从艺请朝, I would translate it doubly, I mean literally, doubly d'interprète, 以请朝, demander à venir à la cour. So you see how parallel, I mean how stylized it is. So that's why we think that it's a very good piece of belles lettres in the history of Chinese literature. Now, Erfwe actually gave a note on this translation by him, par le truchement de plusieurs interprètes. So I just quote his note here, the page 145. Il ne s'agit pas, d'après les textes similaires cités par Morohashi, very page 11,970, et redoublé d'interprète comme traduit par M. Gaspardon, mais d'être obligé d'utiliser plusieurs interprètes en série pour se faire comprendre. And please see those writing of history, blah, blah, blah. And here, the Morohashi actually referred to, I think it is Morohashi Tezuji's Daikanwajiden, so a great dictionary of kanji, the Chinese characters used in Japanese, and it was published in Japan around 1960. And here, Monsieur Gaspardon, I think it referred to Emil Gaspardon, and I think he's a scholar of FL.
I don't know him.
Okay, but anyway, both scholars, Morohashi and Gaspardon, died around 1982. So you see that in this period, 1970s, actually French scholars, sinologists have a very good interactions, relations with the sinologists in Japan and, I mean, in East Asia. So anyway, if we just adopted Herbert's Erfwe's notes, then I would rather retranslate this part into French somehow as joigner les mains and to be paralleled with multiplier leur interprète.
Multiplier.
Okay, sorry. Actually, I just prepared this slide a few minutes before my departure. So then next is the text 2b. That's why I said that already at the beginning of the memory, I mean the report after Sima Xiangru's report back to the Han court. The year was given very clearly, Han Xing Qi Shi Yo Ba Zai. And here you see a yellow passage in small character. Actually, it was a commentary compiled in the middle of the 7th century called Shi Ji Ji Jie, a very important commentary of the Shi Ji. Actually, the gist of this text 2b expressed Sima Xiangru's implicit request or suggestion to the Han Emperor that actually after visiting a local people around Banshu, he found the ambition or the purpose to open the road to the Southeast Asia was not so practical because it was too expensive. So he just wrote a request on the behalf of 7H people from a local area around Banshu and tried to persuade the government, the emperor, that actually it would be wiser to stop this great project.
May I comment a bit?
Yes.
On the previous slide?
Yes.
Oui. C'est vraiment extrêmement, extrêmement intéressant comme passage parce que on peut faire quelques hypothèses. Pour moi, c'est complètement, complètement nouveau par rapport à ce que j'avais lu.
Better say here.
Oui. C'est très intéressant la remarque de Hervouet. Donc, plusieurs interprètes, une chaîne d'interprètes. Bien. Ça veut donc dire, si on lit bien ça, que la langue du Kangqiu n'est pas la langue des Xiongnu. C'est-à-dire que il faut les relations entre les Xiongnu et la cour de Chine sont anciennes. Donc il y a bien entendu un corps d'interprètes qui sait traduire entre les Xiongnu et les Chinois. Bien. Ça ne règle pas le problème de la langue des Xiongnu, qui n'est pas résolu aujourd'hui. Hein. Il y a plusieurs... on n'est pas sûr, en fait, qu'ils aient eu toujours la même langue. Hein. On sait qu'il existe un poème Xiongnu qu'on a mis en rapport avec, je crois, le Ket, une langue sibérienne, qui ne se rattache pas vraiment à une famille connue. Et puis, par ailleurs, il y a l'hypothèse que... certains éléments, peut-être dirigeants parmi les Xiongnu, auraient déjà parlé une langue altaïque, du type proto-turc. Mais c'est un problème qui... C'est un débat en cours, c'est pas un problème réglé. Mais ce qu'on voit, ce que je lis là, moi, c'est que les Kangqiu ne parlent pas la même langue que les Xiongnu. Et ça, c'est très important, parce que ça va avec quelques autres indices dont on aura peut-être le temps de parler la prochaine fois, qui tendrait à indiquer que la langue du Kangqiu, c'est une langue iranienne de type Saka. Voilà, une langue iranienne. Donc ni le Ket, ni une langue sibérienne, ni une langue altaïque. Ça, c'est un premier point. Le deuxième point, la deuxième idée vers laquelle ça amène, c'est que les Kangqiu, bon, on ne sait pas vraiment où ils sont à ce moment-là, mais ils sont certainement voisins des Xiongnu. Voilà, ils sont voisins des Xiongnu. Alors, le problème, normalement, qui est-ce qu'on attend comme voisin des Xiongnu à l'ouest? On attend les Wusun. Et là, on nous parle des Kangqiu. Alors, est-ce que les Kangqiu partagent les territoires de l'actuel Kirghizistan avec les Wusun? Est-ce qu'ils partagent? Est-ce que ce sont des peuples dont l'aire géographique n'est pas encore stabilisée, qui sont en mouvement, et c'est c'est une situation qui est en train de changer? Ou alors, autre idée, les Wusun ne veulent pas entrer en contact avec les Chinois, mais les Kangqiu veulent. Ce qui correspondrait assez bien à une situation qu'on rencontre fréquemment, c'est-à-dire que mon voisin est mon ennemi, mais le voisin de mon voisin est mon ami. Voilà. Peut-être les Kangqiu sont au-delà des Wusun. Les Wusun ne souhaitent pas entrer en contact avec les Chinois, mais les Kangqiu le veulent. Bien. Est-ce qu'ils se contrôlent déjà? Alors, est-ce qu'ils contrôlent déjà la Sogdiane? Bien. Il y a quelques indices, pas beaucoup, mais il y a quelques indices, selon lesquels des relations avec, avec au moins le Xinjiang, le bassin du Tarim, aurait pu déjà s'établir à l'époque des derniers rois grecs de Bactriane. On a un passage dans Strabon qui nous dit, c'est à propos du règne de Cratide, le dernier roi grec de Bactriane. Et on nous dit, les Grecs étaient allés jusqu'au pays des Serres. Le pays des Serres, en principe, c'est la Chine. Mais ça peut être aussi les peuples qui font le commerce de la soie. Ça peut être tout à fait des peuples dans le bassin du Tarim. Donc, peut-être déjà des contacts établis à ce moment-là. Il y a cette question étrange qu'on a vue la dernière fois, du Souyi, la Sogdiane, qui semblerait, dans la première attestation, en fait, se situait plutôt du côté de Kashgar. Donc, est-ce qu'il y a déjà une présence commerciale sogdienne à l'est des Pamirs? C'est pas beaucoup d'indices, ce n'est pas beaucoup d'indices, mais Peut-être que tout ça mis ensemble pourrait amener à réfléchir à la possibilité de contacts commerciaux établis entre les territoires à l'ouest de la Chine et la Sogdiane très tôt, jusqu'à partir de donc les années à peu près 140, c'est le moment de la fin du pouvoir grec en Bactriane, et voilà, et à Samarcande, les Grecs ne sont plus là, mais visiblement, d'après l'archéologie, c'est une époque encore prospère. Voilà, c'est juste quelques remarques que je voulais faire, parce qu'à mon avis, ce passage est vraiment très important. Did you follow what I said? And for me, it's completely new.
So, yes, I just went to the text 2B, but I will not go into the detail of this report. But because this concerns the social economy in the South West China and not actually not involved with our topic in the North West China. But actually, it would mean that as early as around the middle of the second century BCE, the emperor already tried to explore the so-called Silk Road right now, not only to the north, but also to the south. And I think, if you remember, after Zhang Qian's return back to China, he reported that actually in Bactria, in Tokharistan, he found the bamboo stick imported from Sichuan province. And so he supposed that there must be some road from southeast China to Bactria, perhaps via India or another way. So again, he tried to persuade the Wu emperor to restart this very expensive project to open up the Sichuan and today's Yunnan. And
right. Not only bamboo sticks, archaeologically,
yes.
There is silk in Bactria,
yes.
In the late Iron Age.
Yes, but anyway, in Chinese source, what we see is the bamboo sticks from Sichuan and also as a Chinese China grass fabric. That would mean rami fabric. I do not know what is the French term for China grass. Hami? Rami? Rami is a kind of plant fibers. The China grass, do you know?
China
grass. Okay, then maybe I just give a note next time. So, this is what Yu expressed about the dating of text 2A. Again, it was quite lengthy, and he also mentioned that there are several different opinions on how to date this text exactly. And at any rate, as far as I can see, he tried to date this finally around 130 to 129 BCE. And again, in this note, more safely around 130 BC. That's what I tried to adopt it. But at any rate, it was before Zhang Qian's return back to China. So before Zhang Qian's return back to China, the West, I mean the Xi, the Kangju and some other countries in the West already established a kind of contact between the Han court, but we could not trace it anymore. So here is Hersevay's opinion, continued also in the same note. So Elwit suggests that the reference to Kangju offering tribute as a result of Han victory over a Xiongnu is merely a hyperbole or exaggerating used by the poet Sima Xiangru, while noting parenthetically that the classical authors of the West were not averse from similar hyperbole, attributing victories by the Romans over the unknown people of Central China, Central Asia, to Octavianus Augustus. Actually, I do not really know this text.
Yes.
So we feel, namely Hersevay and perhaps also Lavey, feel, however, that the evidence of these two attestations from Dong Zhongshu and from Sima Xiangru does not necessarily imply that Kangju existence first came to the notice of the China as late as a result of Zhang Qian's journey. It may, and even probably does, imply that official Chinese action in respect of Kangju followed only from Zhang's information, but Sima Xiangru and Dong Zhongshu may well refer to a topic or area which featured in everyday talk before it had found its official way, I mean, official way of paying tribute to official.
Les victoires attribuées à Auguste sur les peuples d'Asie centrale, ce sont des... On voit très bien comment ça a été fabriqué. C'est que Auguste a fait la paix avec l'Empire Parthe.
Mm-hmm.
Et il a obtenu la restitution des enseignes, des drapeaux qui avaient été pris sur l'armée de Crassus longtemps avant. Et évidemment, c'est présenté par les historiens romains comme une victoire. En fait, ce n'est pas une victoire. C'est qu'on a fait la paix. Et naturellement, quand on dit Auguste a remporté la victoire sur les Parthes, les historiens romains, ils ont pris leur dictionnaire. Et ils ont... alors les Parthes, alors là ils font... Oui, les Bactriens, etc., etc. On va mettre tous les peuples qui étaient associés aux Iraniens depuis l'époque achéménide. Mais c'est un pur procédé. Ça veut absolument... Ça n'indique absolument rien quant à des... de véritables contacts établis par Auguste avec ses peuples. C'est ce qu'on appelle en rhétorique des chaînes de concaténation.
Mm-hmm.
C'est-à-dire que des noms attirent d'autres noms, etc. C'est de la pure hyperbole.
Yes, and actually,
mais par
this...
contre, je suis d'accord mm-hmm. avec ce...
Okay.
Quand Ilzevé dit que très probablement les Kangchus ne sont pas des inconnus en Chine autour des années 140-130, oui, là, on peut vraiment supposer.
Ok. Yes, and I agree that this kind of hyperbole expression was actually very widely practiced in Imperial China. That they are saying that there are pieces, but actually it's not so. Okay, let's return to this map we used last time, and I have to correct it that last time I again made a typo. I think I gave 1914 here. So, whether Wu Sun was on the road of Zhang Qian or not actually relate to an even more complicated problem on how Wu Sun shift westward from the Dunhuang Hexi corridor here. As I said that, although not so detailed, yes. For example, for this timeline, established by Kuwabala. Also, we said that, okay, Zhang Qian most probably arrived in Bactria around 129, right? But there is always debate until now on how and when the Yue Zhi shift there before Zhang Qian's arrival. So to some scholars, they believe that the Yue Zhi only arrived there a few years before Zhang Qian's arrival, and some others think that to settle down the Iran Bactria would need more time, so it would be safe to estimate a decade or more before Zhang Qian's arrival. And the Yue Zhi's movement from the northwestern China was due to a chasement by Wu Sun, right? And Wu Sun again was shift westward from the more central China, I mean around Hexi corridor near Dunhuang. So actually, we do not know around 130s where was Yue Zhi and where was Wu Sun exactly. There are all kind of debated theories until now. So, Franz, do you have any idea on this?
Je crois que là-dessus, c'est dommage qu'Étienne ne soit pas là parce que je me rappelle d'une discussion une discussion entre Étienne et Corinne Francfort au moment de la soutenance d'une thèse.
Maybe you can stay here, speak here.
You were.
You can speak here. You can speak here, otherwise.
Oui, il y a. Je ne peux pas le dire précisément, mais je sais que la théorie habituellement reproduite, c'est que les Yuechi étaient dans le Kansu. Mais apparemment, il y a des objections. Et ça, Étienne de la Vessière en avait parlé. Il est possible qu'en fait, ils aient été plus à l'ouest. Voilà. Évidemment, c'est lié aussi à la question de ce qu'était la langue des Yuechi. Parce que pendant longtemps, on a supposé que la langue originelle des Yuechi, c'était le tocarien, le kutchéen, enfin, tocarien ou kutchéen. Maintenant, cette idée est abandonnée. Cette idée est abandonnée. Donc, tout ça, ce sont des questions ouvertes. Non. Donc, vers 140, où sont les Yuechi? On ne sait pas. Où sont les Wusun? On ne sait pas non plus. Et où sont les Kankyu? On ne sait pas non plus. Voilà. Malgré tout, c'est quand même un élément. Ben, on peut penser que les Kankyu ne sont contrôlent dès ce moment-là des routes déjà établies avec la Chine ou au moins avec le bassin du Tarim. Parce que à la lumière de ça, c'est seulement avec une à la lumière de ça qu'on peut comprendre que dès 140 environ, ils aient voulu envoyer une mission commerciale en Chine. Là, il y a quelque chose qui pourrait indiquer que dès cette époque, ils exercent un certain contrôle sur le réseau sogdien qui est en train de se mettre en place, ou bien qu'ils ne sont pas trop loin de la Chine. On ne peut vraiment pas aller au-delà. Mais encore une fois, là-dessus, c'est vraiment incertain, mais le passage qui vient d'être discuté est vraiment important du point de vue linguistique, parce que là, c'est un bon argument en faveur du fait que les Kankyu parlent une langue, disons, une langue Sith, une langue Saka, en tout cas pas la même langue que les Xiong. On peut dire ça, mais voilà, je dirais que tout ça, ça amène à. Bon. C'est une tradition historiographique de dire que tout le mérite de l'ouverture de la Chine vers l'Ouest doit être attribué à Chang Qian. Que Chang Qian est l'inventeur de la route de la soie. Et en réalité, on voit très bien que des contacts s'étaient mis en place avant lui. Et que Chang Qian utilise des contacts, des réseaux existants. Son apport spécifique, c'est d'être arrivé à reprendre contact avec les Yuechi, qui sans doute n'étaient pas en Bactriane depuis très longtemps. Je ne crois pas que ce soit plusieurs décennies. On a quand même l'indice des fouilles d'Aïkhanoum. Ou à Aïkhanoum, on voit très bien qu'il y a eu deux périodes de pillage après la chute des Grecs. Et là, on a une chronologie assez bonne. On sait que le pouvoir grec à Aïkhanoum s'arrête à la fin du règne de Cratide, 145. Ce roi qui, peut-être, a déjà établi des contacts à l'est du Pamir. Bon. Et après Eucratide, le matériel archéologique qu'on voit à Aïkhanoum, ce n'est pas du matériel Yuechi, c'est du matériel Saka. C'est ce que la céramique correspond assez bien à des choses qu'on a au Semirechi, hein, non, l'actuel du côté de l'actuel Almaty, Kazakhstan, Kirghizistan, et puis surtout, on a les inscriptions sur les lingots d'argent de la trésorerie qui ont été donc fondus sous le contrôle des nouveaux occupants de la ville. Et cette inscription en caractère runique, c'est la même écriture que ce qu'on a dans la tombe d'un grand chef, disons Saka, le tombeau de Issyk, près d'Almata. Donc là, on voit que la première vague qui arrive dans les années 140 en Bactriane, au moins de l'Est, ce ne sont pas encore les Yuezhi, ce sont des Saka. Et les Yuezhi, là, l'indice et les indications archéologiques ne sont pas très nettes, mais on a l'impression que vers 130, cette phase s'arrête et que là, peut-être, ce sont les Yuezhi qui arrivent. Le problème, c'est qu'on arrive à identifier de la céramique Saka, mais on a beaucoup de mal à identifier de la céramique Yuezhi. Bertil Lyonnais a fait des propositions, mais c'est pas évident qu'on ait vraiment identifié la culture matérielle des Yuezhi à Ehranoum. Ce qu'on voit, c'est qu'il y a quelque chose qui se produit vers 130 qui met fin à une première phase d'occupation par des Saka. Et ça va avec le texte du Hanshu qui nous dit que les Saka, à un certain moment, sont partis, le roi des Saka est parti plus au sud, vers les passages suspendus. Il y a toute une discussion sur l'endroit où situaient les passages suspendus. Donc voilà. Donc je dirais, probablement, quand Chongqian retrouve les Yuezhi au nord de la Bactriane, ils ne sont pas là depuis longtemps.
Although we only have a few minutes, but well, I try my best and only explain the gist. Okay. So, actually, there are another attestation of Kangju at the around the beginning of the founder. I mean, the beginning of the reign of the founder of Eastern Han Dynasty, the Guangwu Emperor. And after this usurper, Wang Mang, and for so many years, the Guangwu re-established Han Dynasty. And because as early as the beginning of his dynasty, he established the capital at Luoyang. That's why we call that his dynasty is Eastern Han. And the former Han Dynasty is also known as the Western Han. So like this. But at the beginning of Eastern Han Dynasty, there was always discussion on whether the court, the imperial court, should be moved back to the Chang'an, because many nobles and educated people missed there very much. So it was in one text, one belle lettre, one piece of belle lettre around the, I think around the 50 years or so among of. After Common Era, that Kangju appeared again. And maybe I only treat this a little bit next time. And right now, this is a belle lettre as a mixture of prose and verse. And here we see that there was rhymes. So I just said, speak it very quickly. 虽命飘寂,情人未清, with a rhyme. And 永为阴阳,君如流星, here's Qing and Xing, and Shen Zhi Xiongnu, the Xiongnu people, right? Ge Lie Wang Ting, so cut and split the order, Wang Ting. So here we have Qing, Xing, Ting, even in today's Pinyin. And if we use Kagran's Old Chinese or Puli Blanc's Early Middle Chinese, again you see there are rhymes, Qing or Qing, Xing or Xing, or Din or Ding. So this is the rhyme of this paragraph, and also a parallel, a very beautiful text. And then, again, here I just speak it quickly and explain the meaning next time. 烧鸡掌细恶之凡康居 burnt the Kangju people, the Kangju state. 灰真奇, and 追鸣敌丁陆里, sorry. And 池坑岸或昆明, here Kunming is the ruler of Wusun. 鲁肃毒 perhaps, or 鲁肃真驱罗驴玉丸马 drive the horse round 大丸 and 边绝蹄 another kind of fine horses, 拓地万里威震八荒赵至四郡据守敦煌。So here it is strange that we find a historical commentary on how to pronounce this kanji here in this verse. So I just translate temporarily. Actually, I did not have much time today this morning. Okay, 康居西域国也，居阴渠。康居 was a state in the western regions. Here, 居 is to be pronounced as the character 渠. So literally, 居 is a residence or living. And 渠 literally means canals, water ditch, water channels. And in Kalgoran, that would mean Qiu or Qia by Polybran's early Middle Chinese. And Qu is almost the same, but the consonant is sounded Giu or Gi. So if we just briefly compare with this Qi, so Fan Kang Ju, burned Kang Ju or burned Kang Qu, and is to be somehow a coordinate to the pronunciation of Qi here. Then we find that qi is to be pronounced anciently gia or gia. So it would mean that if we believe this very old classical commentary on how to pronounce kanji in this verse, the kanji should be somehow pronounced as kangyu, not kangyu. Although, well, it's only a very slight difference, but maybe it could help something for philologist or linguist, right? And the most more important or interesting thing is that here, although from the normal dictionary nowadays, we will find this character to be pronounced as zhen, so maybe su zhen. This is again a very, very rare character that one can almost find from none of modern Chinese dictionary at all. But there was a note on Li Hou Han Shu by the crown prince of the Tang Dynasty called Li Xian. He was the sixth son of the Li Zhi, namely the Tang Emperor Gao Zong, and also with his wife and the second son of Li, thereafter Wu Empress. That this crown prince died very young, just very soon after the death of his father. And he said that in his state, for a known reason, Li Su Du was told to be always pronounced as, I mean, not Su Zhen, but Su Du. So actually, he tried to identify Li Su Du just as Sogdian in his days. If his observation is correct, then this could be the earliest attestation of Sogdian. In the same verse as Kangju, around the 50 or so of the Common Era. But whether this crown prince note is proper or not, I think I just explain it a little bit more next time. Okay, thank you very much.
So, ça correspond bien à l'autodésignation des Sogdiens, sauf que j'ai un vocalisme, the final vowel U is a problem, because in Sogdian it's Surdik. U is not expected as a final vowel. So why this vowel?
We have to go back to this next time. Well, from the literal meaning, it means that these Su Zhen or Su Du people was captured after the Kun Mi, the ruler of Wu Sun, were captured. And also this mule and donkey was drived. And then the fine horse from Dawan was also driven, I mean back to Han China, as well as these fine horses, they were whipped and back to China. I think it's a kind of context that people assume that this very rare and unknown term with the root of human here, in always in the left side, this is the root of human here, must mean a kind of people to appear together with Wu Sun and with the smaller king of Xiongnu and with the Kangju. So from the context, maybe it is possible. But already in Li Xian's time, he could not explain why it was to be specially pronounced as Sudu here. So
I
can only indicate that there was such a special note, and I think it will be the Scotsonian specialist term to treat this problem.
So next time, you follow on the commentary of this text.
Yes, very briefly, just explain the meaning, literal meaning of this verse.
So, alors, donc, Jean-Jean terminera l'analyse de ces textes, et peut-être à ce moment-là, pour terminer, j'interviens sur des éléments de civilisation Kangju, c'est-à-dire l'architecture, la question des villes du Fergana. Parce que maintenant on a des indications assez précises pour les localiser, l'architecture, peut-être la question linguistique, mais je ne sais pas si on aura pu trouver la restitution en ancient Chinese des deux noms Kangju qui sont transmis par les sources, et peut-être aussi parler de l'épisode de fameux du siège de Gigi. Mais bon, je pense que le professeur Inaba assistera peut-être à la prochaine séance.
If we do not speak so much French.
Oh, well, we can do it all in English. We can do it all
well,
in
yes.
English.
Okay.
Because probably if we insist upon elements of material culture, etc., he will be particularly interested and be able to make interesting remarks. Alors je rappelle donc que la conférence du professeur Inaba aura lieu jeudi 22.
Non, jeudi c'est pour nous.
Ah oui, mercredi.
Mercredi.
Mercredi 22 à 5h.
Oui.
De 5h à 6h30, ici même, dans cette salle.